Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Matt Doyle. It's a Thursday morning, crew. We are here because CONCACAF Champions League. That's just a general statement, guys. I don't even know if that, not just on Thursdays, not for a delayed show, just in
just
general, in existence, we are here for CCL. Big show.
We move, correct.
We are the biggest Violette fans on planet Earth. We move to CCL Fever in just a little bit. We'll go through match day four in Major League Soccer. But we start with a little bit of mail from the Pizza King. Self-proclaimed Pizza King says, could you guys do a quick rundown on context for the voiceovers during the intro to the podcast? I've always wondered who and what all the little snippets are about, like, quote, get lost, every single day into the office, into the laboratory. We'll start with a little, you know, it's important to remember we have new listeners. Sometimes
Pizza King, I'm sad that these have not connected for you. So we're going to get you there. The first thing you need to do, because I know it's up online, is Google Jozy Altidore post-championship parade speech. If you put that language in, it should come up. It's one of the greatest moments in my life. TFC won the 2017 MLS Cup. They had a parade. I would argue it was the first parade at that level in MLS history through the streets of Toronto. They filled the entire plaza in front of, I think it's City Hall. I don't exactly know. And I knew Anders was going to do this, and I bet you Timbers fans do this too, and talk about their parades. And of course, the Colorado Rapids 2010, they had a ceremony that was widely attended in Denver. But they had this parade. They did an amazing championship celebration. The city was in love. The fans are in love. And there's one of the great moments of my life, which is, you know, after we're trying to get interviews, but people are celebrating and doing stuff, and I look around, and I see the PR team for Toronto over by the buses setting up interviews and other players down in the crowd. And I look over, I see Jozy Altidore walk to the microphone. And this was the next day. And reminder, that MLS Cup was like a 1 p.m. kickoff. So to say they'd been celebrating for 24 hours is pretty safe. When Jozy picked up the mic and gave one of the greatest speeches in MLS history. And that is what that comes from.
There are certain moments in this show's history where we've done what we might call a brown liquor special. And I think that for Jozy, that was his moment in that genre, so to speak. They won a championship. They did what they were supposed to do. They'd been like grinding towards this and almost there in previous years, and they got over the hump, and they were quite excited. So every day, into the office, into the laboratory we go in honor of Jozy Altidore. The first clip is David Beckham. You can probably recognize his voice. Right before COVID hit, I had the opportunity to sit down with David for just a blindingly brilliant like 4 minutes and 37 seconds that we put on the show. And he fell right into a Wiebe trap, which was I tried to get a clip out of him where he said he listened to Extra Time. And David's very media savvy. He understood from the moment I introduced the concept that he was going to give me the exact clip that I wanted.
You got to stay on Andrew Wiebe's good side. Like David Beckham learned that one real fast in that interview, didn't he?
Yeah, just two guys with good barbers. That's how I always remember that moment. Two guys with good barbers.
I think David Beckham has what you'd call a barber. David Beckham has a hair specialist who he flies in from around the world.
Maybe, but I think in a branding term, he would like it to be called barber, so he gets those,
sounds like a common man.
Those roots.
Just a West Ham fan.
Got to keep those roots strong. Bob Bradley said, get lost to Sebi Salazar in the MLS Cup playoffs. Does anyone remember what the question was?
The question was about Carlos Vela being a big game player or not, because I think the convo going into that wasn't the Western Conference Finals. I think it was the Western Conference Semis. I think they beat the Galaxy in that game. And it was the year LAFC had won Supporter Shield. And the question was, would they choke in the playoffs? Would Vela choke in the playoffs? Then they won that game. Bob felt that game alone was vindication. Sebi Salazar felt it was a fair question to ask about because it was a MLS Western Conference semifinals, which isn't exactly what a lot of people would call the biggest game of your life.
Anders is going hard in the chat right now. Well, Anders knows what the next game was.
The best part is that was Sebi too, right? Yeah. With Schmetzer?
Yeah, that was the better than Bob moment.
Yeah, so Sebi had a good week.
Yeah, he was in prime Sebi Salazar form. Congratulations, by the way, to Sebi and Herc and all the success of Football Americas. I think they're into year three.
Yeah, started year three, and they have a big interview with Christian Pulisic coming out. Yeah, it's probably already come out when you're seeing or listening to this, and it's got a little bit of spice to it from what we've seen from the clips that they've dropped as teasers. Good job, guys.
So ESPN Plus, as always, your spot for Football Americas. The next one is Bruce yanking our chain on this podcast, Bruce Arena. David was very magnanimous, and Bruce was very Bruce. Was like, oh, yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, everything I know I get from this podcast. Exactly, guys. Yeah, yeah.
That was when Bruce came back into the fold and was like, I'm going to be nice to media now. Yeah.
And now he is quite. I mean, I've had some of the best. Entertaining and personable. He always has been, but like he had kind of a grumpiness to him for a long time. I think just, you know, the symptom of dealing with folks like us on a regular basis, probably, but now he seems to be settled in.
When we had him on the World Cup shows, back in November and December, he was like a guest for the watch alongs. He was absolutely fantastic. And like, it's not just, he was fantastic on the shows, and like anybody who knows Bruce Arena knows he has this sort of dry, sardonic wit that is like wildly entertaining, but like there were tech issues. And he was so game to try to troubleshoot these tech issues to the best. Like, he was so nice to all the ops people behind the scenes. And,
yeah. He was an absolute joy.
He was. Bruce Arena.
We owe him a couple drinks at Shellbacks, if that's still a place that he frequents in the offseason. And then, of course, the final one is Jack Edwards calling Clint Mathis's 2002 World Cup goal against South Korea. That's why he's here. And that clip has been in our intro for, forever, maybe. Like, I don't remember a time, Dave, and you used to put these together back in the day before Anders did it. I think that's been here forever, and I don't think it'll ever go away.
That was before me, and it's not the cleanest clip to find. The only version of it that exists is from a sizzle reel that you can find online, and it has music behind it. So you have to like cut it super clean, and then the music we use kind of covers it up. But it's legendary moment, and it's Jack Edwards on the call who did the whole 2002 World Cup. I think he did the 98 World Cup as well and is a famous hockey announcer in the Northeast in Boston. But yeah, it was a great moment. When I listened to the show in college and like wanted to be a part of it and like downloaded every episode, that's what I connected the show with. So I kept it in there forever.
Has it lived up to your expectations, David? Being on the show.
You know what's funny? The first time this is going all the way back, but when I joined, it was Simon Borg, Nick Furshaw, Andrew Wiebe, and then Greg Lawless a bit. And if you had asked me listening to the podcast to draw those characters, I would have drawn Simon as Greg and Greg as Simon. Like the way they looked was the opposite of the way they sounded.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Never thought about it that way.
Simon Borg, the legend.
I still remember, if we're going back on memories here, I still remember the day that Dave came into the old MLSsoccer.com offices over on, what, we were on 38th Street, I think?
Yeah.
And did an interview with Simon, and then we had a chat in the very small kitchenette. and then for many years, Dave was Dave was not only a host as you moved into that, but also the person who just rolled his eyes at me every time. I was like, do you hear this? Do you hear this noise? Like, I hear noises within the show.
We had the worst equipment, yeah.
And soon enough, we will have better equipment. We're going to be in the studio soon, folks, I promise. It sounds like in the next 2 weeks.
A glow up.
I'll tease it that way, and it'll be a welcome return to in-person recording for us. But that is the story behind the intro, and we are looking for new intro clips. If it ain't broke, don't fix it situation, but it sort of feels like it's time to update when we move into the studio. So if you have any clips from around the league, sound bites from interviews, sound bites from post games, just literally any noise that you think would be good in an extra time intro, let us know. We'll go find it.
What was the Daniel Shalloway one? Was that last year or the year before? He ethered somebody.
2020, and it was San Jose.
Yeah. It was Almeida
Ball. The key to why it's so good is it ends so childish, where he's like, I don't like San Jose, and I don't think they deserve anything ever. And it's like when a kid's like, I love you this much, or infinity. Like, that's kind of what it feels like, and I absolutely love that.
That was the first
I'm not a fan of San Jose. Playing against them, they are playing very dirty football, and I don't think they deserve points ever.
Ever. Just the way he's looking at the interviewer, too, and just like sort of being like, no, never, never. Like, and I have a intimate knowledge of that sort of logic, given I'm raising two children at the age of 5 and 2 right now. Shout out to Daniel Shalloway for that one. So if you have anything like that, hit us up. Hit us on the email, extratimeatmlsoccer.com, or tweet him at us, or tweet him at Anders, Sports Viking. Into CCL fever we go. But first, congratulations to the Seattle Sounders. Much like the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, they've qualified for something without actually doing any qualification efforts. They are now in the 2025 Club World Cup. They've invented qualifying for that competition out of MLS, whether they're winning CONCACAF Champions League or just getting the golden ticket. It's now been confirmed by the Federation that the winners of 2021, so that's Monterrey, 2022, 23, and 24, the CCL competitions, will qualify for the expanded 2025 Club World Cup. And congratulations to Nuhu, who has signed a contract extension to be available for the occasion in 2025. The Sounders had to just lock that one up, make sure Nuhu was available. Any thoughts on this, guys, or are we just... I guess we could like pipe
any
in Anders here.
On this team auto qualifying for past performance to a competition we've never seen before?
Yes.
No, I think I feel good on that. Let me ask this. We'll probably do this in a moment. If LAFC wins CCL,
mm-hmm.
they just need to make the playoffs, and the 12-month span is the best in MLS history, right?
I think so, yeah.
Like, to make the playoffs. Basically,
To win the double, then win CCL, then just make the playoffs. Yeah, you've had the best 12-month run in MLS history.
What's the right strategy for, like, given the expansion of the playoffs and the fact that it's three games, like, if you get into the three games, would you like to host two? 1,000% you would. It ups your odds of advancing significantly, I would think. We don't know yet. We haven't played it. But if you are Steve Cherundolo and LAFC, and you, let's say you win CCL, I'm like the knock on wood 1,000 times here, how would you approach the rest of the season? Would you put all your eggs into MLS, or would you say, we're going to go win League's Cup and US Open Cup is there for us? Like, we could win a treble before we even get to the playoffs.
So I think because of the format of League's Cup, where it doesn't run in conjunction with the regular season, it's less of a juggle than Open Cup is or CCL traditionally has.
Plus the bye. I mean, they have bye through the group stage.
That's
they
fair,
need to win, what, 4 games to win League's Cup? 3 games?
Yeah.
So I would say League's Cup would be a point of focus for them. But as Doyle said, I don't think that takes away from other competition, but if you ask like Open Cup versus MLS, I would say the focus would be making the playoffs.
Yeah, and in US Open Cup for LAFC this year, you're going to see like Crisostomo and Tony Leone and Christian Torres and like all these academy kids that you've never heard of. Those are the guys who you're going to see for LAFC.
That they've also, Open Cup. That Cherundolo's also never heard of, right. We shall see.
All right, let's talk about...
Did we just inadvertently crown LAFC CCL champions? Because they lost last night.
Yeah, that's true, but they won.
That's a big loss. That's a big out.
Let's start with the team that lost and the world was talking about it. Violette 3, Austin FC 2 on aggregate. Of course, Violette 3-0 winners in the Dominican Republic, and then Austin huff and puff and try to blow the house down, and the little pig was left standing and are moving on to the next round. What an incredible, historic, heroic performance by Violette in every way. And we'll get to sort of the humiliation and embarrassment of Austin. But I think that the real story, as Connor, Northern Sunset 3, hit this up all the time. He said, please, guys, spend a bit of extended time talking Violette and what they've endured to get where they are. Genuinely inspiring. That's where we'll start. Violette hadn't played a competitive match in, I think the number is, people were saying 300. I saw 289 days, like 11 days don't matter in all this. It had been a long time since they played a competitive match. Haiti's in turmoil politically. The people there are in a rough moment. There's no league to play in for them right now. They did win the Caribbean Cup to get into this competition back in late May 2022. They won that in the Dominican Republic as well. There were much documented visa issues for Violette to get to Austin to play. There was a question mark as to whether they would even be able to make that trip. And you remember last year with Cavalli, they had to forfeit against the Revs. That I don't think that was even played, right? They didn't even play a single match of that one. So just playing a match was an accomplishment, let alone a 3-0 dominant win in leg one. And then six Violette starters from the first leg win, that's all they could bring. Just six of the starters that won 3-0. They had a backup goalkeeper. Paul Decius is in goal. You know, they picked up some players in the U.S. You know, we were talking on the last show about like FC Motown and just sort of like put the call out, man. And even still, you look at that bench, you pull it up, you see the broadcast, like they have 14 players available. 14. Now, they were a tad fortunate in some of their visas. The entire back line from the home leg carried over. Their captain, Steven Saba, was able to come as well. And we'll remember him from, you know, Montreal days as well as from Gold Cups past. I mean, I think, in 2019, Haiti made that run to the semis, I want to say.
They beat Canada, and he is Canadian.
Yeah. It's incredible that they were able to do this. And we can get into sort of the details of the game, I guess, Dave. But let's just start with the accomplishment. This is, and I trust John Arnold, I trust Archbell, all these people around the Federation who are saying this is the biggest upset in CONCACAF Champions League history. In the modern version, a Haitian team had never won in the knockout round, had never advanced. And to do it against Austin in this fashion with these sort of obstacles in their path, we'll never forget this, ever.
This is why we love this competition, because it brings so many different people from so many different parts of this region together where, you know, not everything's the same. Not everything's straight line everywhere. And so you feel it in the preparation for what you talked about last year. We thought this tie wouldn't be played. Like the reports coming out before CCL even started was that Violette wouldn't be eligible to play in CONCACAF and then in CCL. Then they have to host in another country. And then obviously what you talked about with the players, the length of time since they played a game. Then they came out and dunked on Austin. 3-0 with a metal drum in the background the entire game in a stadium in a country that they're not from. Like everything about that is unique to this region. And it was, as you said, something they had to overcome. And so for them to do that, to come into the second leg, Austin gets the early goal or gets that first goal. And that's where you start feeling like, uh-oh, how's this going to go? Austin puts up, what, 20 shots? But they put up, 20 shots in the first half? I think five on goal. Backup goalkeeper making unreal saves. And then I think the big thing to me is after the second goal, the mistake from the goalkeeper, the crowd's against you. You're exhausted. You have no subs. You're not match fit. A lot of these guys have never met before, let alone played at a high level. You're playing against a team that's four games into their season, that had full training camps, that has played together for 3 years now in a cohesive manner. And for them to hold on at that point was amazing. And it was like, I haven't asked. I listened to a bit of the Twitter spaces after. I think Austin FC fans were like happy for Violette. They were devastated that their team lost, but that's how great a story this is. And I think how this sport connects us to each other, that you're like, yeah, that sucks, but you have to respect what they've been through.
Let me read this quote, Doyle, then we'll get sort of your thoughts on what Violette accomplished here. This is from Ronnie Atimi, their coach. And you saw him on the sideline. You saw the emotion when the final whistle blew. Quote, keep struggling. Keep believing. Because in adversity, goodness comes out of it. Today, for example, we knew we were going to suffer. We knew we would go through difficult moments. We knew we would have to put our hearts into it. We could not expect that someone was going to come help us out. We only had 14 players, but we fought. This is the message. Keep struggling, keep fighting, and change the situation for ourselves. And that is poetic in soccer terms from what we saw. It is also poetic in geopolitical, cultural, day-to-day life terms for this coach and his players.
Yeah, what they went through just as athletes and coaches to get to this point is remarkable. And it is a reflection, unfortunately, of the turmoil that the whole country is in, the whole country has been in for hundreds of years. I can't recommend strongly enough reading a bit about Haitian history and finding out, like getting historical perspective for why Haiti has struggled for so long with violence, with poverty, with, you know, basic living standards. This goes back to the Haitian Revolution 225 years ago, when they were a slave state and they won their independence. They fought and they won their independence from France. And I believe it is the only, you know, slave state that actually did that. And as a result of that, the Western world mostly refused to recognize Haitian independence, and for Haiti to stay independent over the next 50, 60 odd years, they had to pay reparations to France for their own victory. That was the economic lever that the Western powers were able to bring to bear, and it resonates still today. And we've seen it, the impacts have been long lasting, and it feels like sometimes it must feel like it's irreparable. So little moments like this, and sports is little in the bigger picture, just you have to be able to take joy from it. And it was certainly like it was wonderful to watch them celebrate. And I hope that the Haitian people who watched that were able to take joy from it. And I hope that there are bigger and more meaningful and more lasting reasons for joy to come for that entire country, because they've been through it, man, and they're still going through it.
Looks like probably Leon for them in the quarterfinals. We're still waiting on the final result from Leon Taro, but just to sort of put a voice to that emotion, to that accomplishment, to the suffering that, you know, as the manager said, they knew they were going to have to go through. Here's Steven Saba after the match.
This is for the boys at home, because we went through a lot, man. We went through a lot, and we didn't have our best players. We fought and fought and fought. So this means a lot to us, man.
I mean, that is, you can.
I hope they win the whole thing.
Yeah,
man.
You can just feel the level of. Yeah, I don't know how to describe what you would be feeling in that moment. I can't describe it. I didn't do it. I didn't feel it. I didn't have those circumstances to overcome. Violette did it. And I don't think, like I said, we'll just never forget that.
Yeah.
That accomplishment, that moment. And there's a flip side to that, which is that somebody's going to be the loser. And Austin FC are that loser in their first time out in the CONCACAF Champions League. There were some moments that they will rue. I mean, certainly some of their own opportunities to finish. Certainly some referee decisions that we'll get into in a second. Jason Fugate hit us up and said, will there ever be a greater MLS humiliation than Austin losing this particular tie? What word would you use to describe this for Josh Wolf, Austin FC, and this particular group of players, guys? Is there a...
Probably that word.
Humiliation? Embarrassment?
Yeah. I mean, not the type of person who normally jumps up and down on people and yells at them, but I think if it's put out there, yeah. I guess this was the best way I could describe it. Jill Sakovitz, who works with us, tweeted out a really good tweet of like encompassing what happened. And like the Liverpool, Chelsea, Man U people in my life texted me and saw it and were like, what happened here? Like, what is this? And so you take in everything that happened, the situation they were in, and you take in the way it went down to lose 3-0, right? To go like 3-0s, you're blown out. So you go play a team that hasn't played a competitive game in 300 days and you get blown off the field. I think that's the word that comes up because of the way you handled it, right? The way you rotated your roster, the way you treated the game, the way you prepared for it, and then the way you performed. So I think, yeah, that would be the one that you think of it. And they'll have complaints, right? We'll talk about the ref. Like, they'll have complaints about the way it went down. But if you are on the losing side of the greatest upset ever, I think UVA in Kansas can tell you, like, you are remembered.
Wow.
Ali Farikwa.
Farouk Namesh. Maybe Farouk Namesh? I don't know. Northern I can't.
Northern Iowa, unite.
We're on the brink of March Madness, right? I can't relive this stuff. I know it's possible. I know it's coming in.
I will turn it in a different direction. I'll say it was a wake-up call. It was a reality check. Forget the emotional part of the humiliation. Focus on the game model. What we saw was 58 crosses from Austin FC. And granted, it's not the worst idea to cross a bunch against a team that was really struggling in the air. But like, they were playing in Violeta, they were playing a 4-5-1. There was room to get the edge with just a little bit of combo play. Create your triangles, bring one of the central midfielders over and the strong side winger and overlapping fullback, create your triangles, get somebody to the end line to then drive the ball off the dribble into the golden zone, into those Man City zones on the side of the box for pullbacks, right? If you're going to attack out wide, and Violeta, they were doing everything they could to force you to attack out wide. Be patient. Trust your skill, trust your teammates to have those patterns of play and get to optimal spots to create scoring chances for the forwards. They did not do that. They did not do that. I can't think of a single time that they actually worked a little combination play like that. Like the Ragone assist was just like, he bent it in from the sideline. You know,
one or two where Gallagher got to the end line and pulled back that they played him in. But the oddest part about what happened to me was Gallagher, I get that he scored two goals, but he's out there because he's a right-footed right back, and they slid Owen Wolfe out wide for the last like 35 minutes. They pinched Gallagher and Bergoni in, and they had Owen Wolfe just whipping in crosses from the right side. And you specifically said last year, he's not a winger. He doesn't play out there. And I thought he struggled to hit a decent cross throughout the end of that game. So not only did they hit crosses, but they took the players who were on the field to cross the ball away from those zones and put them in the goal. And it was entirely from the right side,
I think,
too.
Well, I think part of this was they had to get Ragone inside.
But Gallagher?
But listen to me. They had to get Ragone inside because if he's out there, those triangles, those combinations don't come off because he is not – like, he just does not have the speed to create separation against any – there was a time one of the Violeta defenders literally fell down and Ragone could not create separation from him on the dribble. Like so he handicaps them in terms of what they can accomplish on that right side, in terms of doing anything other than like ping it back and forth for a minute, then pull back to your left foot and try to bend it in, you know, kind of an in-swinger to the back post. And they were doing the same thing on the other side as well. It was disappointing to see. And it's a reality check for Josh Wolf and for this team about the game model. Like, there needs to be something more than settling for crosses, especially when you have skill in central midfield. You know, like Owen Wolf, yeah, he struggled to put in a good cross. He's a good little player, man. Danny Pereira is maybe the most underrated player in MLS. I'm willing to say that about him after what I've seen to start the season this year. He was so strong last year, and I think that was underappreciated. And we know that Driussi is good. The Driussi showed in this one, he's much more a creature of the box than he is a creator. But there are opportunities there to change, to use Violeta's defensive posture against them in a way that just Austin did not take. They settled time and time again. And that is the story of this game, more so than the ref, not more so than the upset. The big story of this game, of course, is the upset, but like more so than anything that the ref did. I thought the ref was mostly fine, you know, more so than missed chances. It was settling for banging on the same door in the same way for the full 90 minutes and never trying to find a back entrance.
Should we talk about Ocean Nation, the referee, and some of the video review decisions? Driussi had a goal in the first half that was called back for an Ethan Finlay handball. Finlay sort of, it's one of those where it kind of comes up on him and you see the way he brings it down and gathers it and controls it. And it's like, is that shoulder or is that bicep? And in the moment, it was not called a handball. And Nation went to the monitor, and it was a theme of the night, quite a lengthy review process, and it was taken back as a handball. Now, it was in that zone, Dave, where it is quite debatable, where we're not exactly sure based on the angles, because IFAB laws state that it's not just like edge of the shoulder. It's not any part of the arm from the shoulder down. There is basically like a very tight t-shirt where within that shoulder pocket, I often like sort of mentally call it like,
I have a good picture of it that Howard Webb sent us one time.
Yeah, like you under, like it's in the laws. Like they have it right there. It's like a tight t-shirt basically. And then from the edge of that t-shirt sleeve down, that's a handball, but above it onto the shoulder, not a handball. It could have hit the bicep. It also could have just been in that little pocket. What did you think of that call?
Oh, we're doing IR here? Yeah, I didn't realize that's what we're doing.
You don't have to. You can
That call I thought was fine. It's the penalty on Zardes that wasn't called to me. That's the obvious one. The ball is on the right side of Zardes. The defender's on the left side. The defender touches the ball through Giassi Zardes. To me, that was the biggest complaint for Austin. That's a goal. If they get the penalty, I know we're not supposed to say it that way, but it is. That gets them enough to at least tie that thing.
And then go on to lose in PK shootout.
Whatever happens from
Team of Destiny, we know.
Right. That I can't say. But to me, that was the big one that stood out in the calls. And listen, this is a referee. I have called a ton of games that he's been on. He did multiple World Cup qualifiers in the last round of World Cup.
He's a FIFA referee.
He is one of the highest levels in this region. But they made some bad calls on the day. Now, one of the issues with the game is obviously Austin's so far behind. The game was so hectic. There are so many actions that you're probably going to get blown calls in your attacking box in a game where you take 32 shots because you need to, and it's all over the place and it's crazy, and you're not going to get every call. They didn't get any of them though, and that's the tough part.
There was a Giassi Zardes goal also that was called back for offside that looked tantalizingly close, but close is not enough. And we've known that for years and years and years, forever in CONCACAF Champions League.
Five games, Zardes still doesn't have a goal. That's good stuff.
Is it concerning?
Yeah, a little bit. He doesn't look like he's moving well. He doesn't look like he has any chemistry with Giroussi. I think they're occupying the same spots. It was the concern that we talked about ahead of the season where Giroussi and Zardes kind of score their goals in the same way. So I trust him. I trust them to figure it out to a degree. But I think it limits their upside, for one. And for two, the other thing that really bothered me about this, he doesn't look engaged defensively. If you go back and you watch that game, like the first hour or so, Violeta, they were getting their chances to break, to go out on the counter. Now, they weren't making anything of it, but like they were getting through that first line of Austin, I guess I'll call it pressure, but it was really a lack of pressure. They were getting through that really, really easily, which made Wolf and Pereira and the fullbacks have to do a lot of work chasing. And like that is a concern, because one of the things that was underappreciated about last year's team was how much work Max Iarruti did defensively for the rest of the attack. And in this game, it was kind of like laid bare, I think, just how poor that Austin repress is from the attackers. Rigoni doesn't do anything. Giroussi is brilliant as he is in the attack. He's like, nobody's going to mistake him for Nico Ladero defensively. And Giassi, Ethan Finley was not particularly engaged defensively. And Giassi has been very good in the past, but he was not. Like, he did not, like, he looked disengaged. And that concerns me more than the lack of finishing, because one of the things that was so much better about Austin in 2022 than 2021 was their ability to, if not stop, at least slow down transition or counterattacking moments at the point of attack, because Arruti was selling out every single moment he's out there to make that first pass out of the back hard. They didn't have anybody in the front four doing that in this game.
Any final thoughts on this one, or can we move on? Because Oscar Preah has some thoughts on Tigres. And
yeah, we should move on. But like the Austin game this weekend is going to be one of the more interesting games to keep an eye on, to see how they bounce back from this. Because if I recall correctly, after the Revs face planted last year in the second round against Pumas, they came back to MLS. Did they lose like five straight games or something like that?
I would have to look that up. But Austin have bounced back twice. They're in Houston on Saturday night. MLS season pass on Apple TV, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. This one doesn't count for Copa Tejas. The first two matches between Texas teams don't, as they sort of like equalize the schedule. So this is like a freebie. It's a bonus Copa Tejas game, you might say.
Oh, my God.
I'm just saying. Just making the argument, putting it out there. Tigres 1, Orlando City 1. Bleep the away goals rule. Just helped you out there, Anders. Make sure you don't have to do any work on the back end. Here's how Orlando City supporters are feeling on this Thursday morning. From Anakin, who are the biggest diving, time-wasting cheaters in all of CONCACAF, and why is it Tigres? There's like 500 words of Oscar Pereja quotes here, and I'll try to just trim it down here. Tigres up 1-0, and then Erkan Kara in the 89th minute has an incredible. Are we calling that a bicycle, or is that kind of an overhead kick? What is that? I don't think it's full bike, right? It's like
overhead. I'm okay calling it a bike, but I'm not a
whatever it is. It's sick.
I'm not a truther on that.
It's sick. Yeah. And then there's 5 minutes of stoppage time, and Oscar Pereja did not believe that those minutes of stoppage time were adequately given. He talked about how in the World Cup you had many, many more minutes given because actual soccer wasn't being played. So here's Oscar Pereja. We played against a good rival and we were there. And I can hear Oscar say we were there. I just can hear him say that. We will go on, but we were upset as well. I know the players were upset with what happened in the last 7 minutes. Obviously, we are not bad losers. Oscar Pereja did get a red card after with this one, arguing with the referee. But that's just context for this quote. We are respectful, but we are not stupid. Great quote. Congratulations to Tigres. It is a club I respect a lot. We played hard. And so Oscar is talking about how they scored in the 89th. In between the 89th and 96th, there was like 45 seconds of actual gameplay because Tigres was delaying. Nahuel Guzman was doing Nahuel things, which he has done many, many times before in CONCACAF Champions League. So Oscar was upset about the goalkeeper not playing, not restarting, substitution, celebrations of the goal. He says the referees have to understand that. Again, he says, we're not stupid. We are not. We are competing. And it was a good game between two great teams. And Duncan Maguire, Doyle, had a chance to make this all different.
Yeah. Would have been a hero, man.
Skied that final chance and just fell to the ground.
Caught it.
You were the chosen one, Duncan.
Just the fact that he's out there getting chances and like obviously him and Kara changed the game as Orlando were throwing the kitchen sink in. I just want to say, like, from a big picture perspective, Orlando City in their first CCL trip going against what is the best team in North America in Tigres, like they have been the big dogs for the past dozen years. This was the type of two-legged series that as recently as 3 years ago, we would say, I hope they can keep it within three goals. And they went out there, they got the draw at El Volcan, they came back, they went down 1-0, and people were texting me, like, this ends 4-0. Like, as soon as Orlando City open it up and chase the game, it's going to look like the final 25 minutes of that Revs LAFC game on Sunday night, where a close 1-0 game turned into a blowout. And I was thinking, I was like, yeah, probably. They're gonna like Schlegel will get burned 1v1, or they'll give up something on a set piece, or
all those things happened. They just had Gaiase.
Gaiase was incredible. To be fair, yeah. But at the same time, like we remember what those games looked like when Sporting Kansas City got absolutely run off the pitch against Monterrey. And the last 15 minutes of the game, none of that stuff was happening. The last 15 minutes, it was Tigres holding on for dear life as Orlando City just jammed the pedal down and were dangerous on every set piece, were dangerous every time they went forward. I still think these two teams, they play this series 10 times. Tigres probably win 7, probably maybe 8. Like they just have so much talent throughout their entire squad that it remains an uphill climb for basically any MLS team against the two Monterrey sides from Liga MX. It just spent so much more money. But it was a really, really great performance from Gaese. It was a really, really good performance from Orlando City. It showed heart and relentlessness, and a level of defensive solidity that, you know, is, I think, going to serve them well in the regular season. And it shows how close we are. I kept looking at that thinking, like, man, if there was one more DP caliber player, or if there was a fully fit Antonio Carlos on the field for this Orlando City team, it's not just toe-to-toe. It's maybe Orlando City coming away with that second goal, or even not even giving up the first, you know, and coming out of there with a result. But it was like, I understand the frustration for Orlando City fans, but like, you got to be proud of that, man. That was 180 big boy minutes. That's what that was.
That felt like a best offseason MLS / Martino Hayda dig from you there. Just asking the question.
Well, you said if they had one more DP, and I think if they had any of their attacking DPs in any level of form, Facundo Torres as well.
Yeah,
Torres did not look good in this series.
It's just, he looks like just a guy. You know?
He has not looked good so far this season.
Yep.
None of the attacking pieces are cohesive. And I agree with everything Doyle said. Like, this is Tigres. This is the monster of the region. Without Gignac, you're at home, but still.
They still have Ibanez, man.
Yeah.
Like, Ibanez probably the best center forward in MLS, you know? Like,
but they had like 34% possession in the first half, and they really didn't start creating chances until they threw everything forward and were down a goal. And while that's not a knock to do against Tigres, they have scored no open field goals yet this year.
What?
They've scored one. So the concern is sort of what the concern's been pre-Oscar Pereja in Orlando, which is how do they consistently create chances when it's not throwing everything forward at the end of a game, creating chaos and having energy in the atmosphere, right? It was the James O'Connor days. Like, that's been Orlando's story. The point of these signings was to change that. It's hard to look at what's happened so far because they rotated their lineup twice in MLS action and they played the best team in the region. So we can't read totally into it, but that's, I think, some of the frustration. And that's part of the issue with why I kept mocking you guys about the best offseason thing is MLS isn't actually geared super well to have a great offseason and be successful really quickly. And the question is how long it will take for all of these guys to hit.
It's like a theorem for this.
Where that will fit. Well, but like, you guys talk to me about Martino Hayda, and I get he's a little bit older than a U22 signing. But outside of Miguel Almirón,
well, he's a straight DP signing. Yeah.
How many 24-year-old DPs have come into this league and been the best player on their team? That's one of the best teams in the league.
Well, I thought the hope was that he wouldn't have to be, I guess. That's where the hope was, is that Facundo Torres was ready to take that step and would be that step. And a lot of the pressure sort of initially would fall on Torres. And then just sort of the depth of quality that Oscar had brought in would pay off in that way. But like Oscar teams generally start slow, and they're generally not just chance creation engines. You know, correct me if I'm wrong here, Doyle.
You're correct.
It's not usually what we see, so I don't think it's a huge surprise when you see them struggling to create clear chances early in the season outside of, like, again, throwing the sink and kitchen sink and, like, set-piece opportunities and just sort of one-off moments. The question is, can Poppy get them into that place through, you know, the next couple weeks / months?
I just think, personally, from what we've heard, that we should add, correct me if I'm wrong, Doyle, to the intro.
That's fair.
So my take on this is you are correct. So I don't need to correct you on that. The addition I would make is I suspect that Oscar Pereja looked at this matchup against Tigres and said, we're spending the first 3 months of this entire season, including preseason, so January, February, March, working on our defense so that we don't lose 6-0 over two legs, so that we give us a chance over the final 20 minutes of the second leg of this home and home to steal a goal and steal the result in advance to the quarterfinals.
And they were there.
So close.
They were there. So Angulo close. Flashes it by that right post. I mean, the chance for Duncan Maguire at the end, Ramiro Enrique had a couple that were just like, oh God, if you just had the direction just a tad different, it's not directly into the goalkeeper's chest. Yeah. Different story.
I don't think this team is going to come out of the gates after this and start scoring three goals a game, but I think you're going to see them ramp up, as you pointed out, as Parejas teams tend to do. You're going to see them ramp up their possession, their attacking numbers, and they're going to start looking a lot more dangerous, especially because Duncan McGuire, clearly the best center forward on the team, going to be out there every single week leading my Golden Boot draft team.
McGuire leads this team in goals. If they spent that much money to have Duncan McGuire lead this team in goals, I think it will actually be an indictment on the way this team's built. And if this is the same as, every Oscar Pareja team, that will also be an indictment. We don't create a lot of chances. It takes us time. We're a team that's defensively based. Great. How much did they just spend in the attack over the last year?
That's a little bit spicy.
But do we not do this with every team?
I don't think it's unfair.
Within Dallas, he did as much as he could with the parts he had, right? He turned Mauro Diaz, turned him, whatever, into an MVP. Castillo was great. But if you go out and sign these players, there's higher expectations than just being hard to beat.
Let's put a pin in this one for now. But this is a great discussion that we should revisit a month, 2 months from now, because this is I wasn't necessarily there with you guys, but you might be making a good point.
LAFC 4, Alajuelense 2. The Costa Ricans pushed
LA. And you make it sound a lot easier than it was.
Yeah, they pushed LA in LA, and then a Carlos Vela goal, and I think the 83rd sort of closed this one down. Any big thoughts from this one? We got Doug Johnson hitting us up about Latif Blessing and LAFC's failure to sell. We could jump into that one.
I think this was another example of just how hard this is. LAFC are the reigning MLS Cup champions. They went down and won 3-0. They tried to rotate a little, not even in a disrespectful way. Like, they played Aaron Long. Like, there's a clear minute split right now between Long, Murillo, and Chiellini, the way the three of them have rotated the last three games. Same with Cifuentes, Ilie, and Kellen Acosta. And Alajuelense put them, you know, gave them everything they could handle and pushed them. So I think that's what I walked away from this game with, is like, this is really tough. This competition is super hard. These teams are good. And Alajuelense, I was surprised by what happened last week. Now you walk away 4-2 over the course of the tie, and you're like, yeah, that's kind of what I expected.
You know what would make it easier? Roberto Firmino.
I thought you'd say more good player.
Oh, Robert. Robert will get it done. He'll get it done. We'll save this Doug Johnson email about sort of the lack of sales for LAFC, selling up, quote unquote, for a different day. Vancouver, Real España, that will be the matchup in the next round here in the CONCACAF Champions League. Vancouver, LAFC, so all MLS in that one. Vancouver, 5-0 winners at home. They lose 3-2 in just a classic daytime match in Honduras. Just at CCL, football heritage, as Anders might say. Vancouver, Joshua Griffith calls it a watered-down lineup. I call it a Canada strong lineup. Dave, second leg, play some of the kids, did Vanny Sartini. Does Vancouver have a chance against LAFC?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a team they've faced before, so it'll be more comfortable, less travel. They won Canadian Championship last year because they're pretty comfortable in knockout competitions. So 100% they'll feel that they have a chance, especially having a DP center forward like Cordova sort of banging in goals so far.
Philly 4, Alianza 0. It's going to be Philly Atlas. That is our only Liga MX MLS matchup, I believe, in this next
round. Don't put it in the chat. I'm not outing you here, I don't think. But you were like, I think I'd rather Atlas if I'm Philly than Alianza. Yeah. Atlas have been in horrendous form. They lost their manager last year after winning back-to-back titles. They've lost players as well. Jairo Torres, we know. They are a mess. But we have a friend who was at the game yesterday when they came back. They were down 4-1, I believe.
Yep. Yes.
Coming into the second leg and came all the way back. So, you know, you go down to Guadalajara. It's going to be a vibe for sure. Mm-hmm. Against Philly, but this, I don't know how to word this. This should be one of the safer MLS versus Liga MX ties we've ever had. Now, in saying that, a record-setting Revs team lost 3-0 in the second leg at a bad Pumas team last year. to get knocked out, and that, baby, is CCL.
Hear that, Anders? That was a bad Pumas team.
Oh, and by the way, that Revs team was without their star injured goalkeeper, and that was the difference in the second leg. And Andre Blake.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, so on that side of the bracket, it's Vancouver LAFC, Atlas Philadelphia. On the other side of the bracket, I think we're still waiting, but you would think it would be Tigres Pachuca and then Violette de Leon, but TBD on those for these Thursday night ties. So that sort of sets it up for Liga MX MLS. You know, knock on wood. seen crazier things happen before than Atlas running the gauntlet here, but would seem to line it up for maybe even an LAFC Philadelphia semifinal, to harken back to the Shield as well as MLS Cup last year. And then, again, a final between MLS and MX. We'll see. Don't get your hopes up. Free space, always disappointment. MLS Match Day 4 is here. Speaking of LAFC, they are going to Seattle to start things off on Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern, MLS Season Pass and Big Fox. What are you looking forward to in this game, Doyle?
I want to see if Seattle's going to continue to try to build from the back. That's been one of the things that we saw from them going back a month and a half now to their Club World Cup appearance. Like, they have been really kind of dedicated to using the ball in a way that we haven't always seen from Brian Schmetzer teams. And I like it. Like, it's fun, especially because Joao Paulo's out there and he has looked like he's 100%. And if you have two deep lying midfielders who are as comfortable on the ball as he and Albert Rusnak are, then, like, yeah, use the ball. And then Jackson Reagan's a very good distributor. He doesn't do much in terms of carrying the ball off the dribble, but, like, he can ping a pass. And Yamargo Gomez Andrade, like, he has leveled up over the past 2 years, both in terms of his ball carrying and just line-breaking passes. So they have been trying to do that game after game after game, and it burned them last week a little bit against Cincinnati, though it was actually Nico Ladero who got a little bit sloppy. It was nobody in the back line or in the deep midfield when they, you know, a Ladero turnover ended up being a Brenner goal for the 1-0 loss. They're facing an LAFC team that is relentless and vicious with their own pressure. We saw that against the Revs. As soon as the Revs started to be expansive out of the back, LAFC swarmed them. They were all over them. We saw it last night in CCL. Like, I know it ended as a 2-1 loss, but go back and watch that game, man. They had chance after chance after chance off of turnovers that they would force, usually in central midfield, right? They press high, but they're not trying to win the ball high. They're trying to make you make risky passes. And they've been that midfield's been very, very good at picking off those types of passes, or at least winning those 50-50s and just transitioning directly into chances. So it's kind of a styles make fights game. And it's a little bit of a weird reversal because it was, you know, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, it was always LFC trying to use the ball and Seattle saying, okay, you can have it. We'll counterattack. They weren't high pressing, but we'll counterattack you. And that always worked out really, not always, but it often worked out really well for Seattle. So, but yeah, that's
the interesting part about this, right? Is we're going to find out how grounded to this style Seattle is.
Yes. Right?
There's a team that won MLS Cup without taking a shot. Like, they have never cared before. And we don't know if they care now or if what they assessed from last year was we need more ways to win games. And this is one of the tools in our club. In our bag, clubs and bags. How do you, Weeby, give me a title listing.
This is one of the, yeah.
There's a five iron.
This is one of the clubs in the bag.
Yeah. Wait, okay. So, you guys want the actual club for the press.
The press. Weeby's not paying attention.
Yeah, the question is this their driver?
It's like a three.
Right?
I don't know.
Yeah, because you're pressing a little bit. No, I don't know.
So, yeah, that'll
And you
that'll
hit
be...
it. If you can hit it, you're going to be one of the best players in the teams in the league. If you can't hit it.
But that'll
You're not
be what's
score
interesting.
On the par fives, all right? Like, just
so. Okay. Sorry, Seattle. They did not have possession against Cincinnati a lot because Cincinnati didn't let them. They were on the road, fine. But so that's, I think, the most interesting part about this game is just like what Seattle decides to do, and then when met with opposition to it, whether they try and fight through it or they switch what they do, they go over the top, they find Jordan Morris and Christian Roldan, you know, in space and start to attack that way.
Most interesting matchup on the field, I think, is Denny Bawanga against Alex Roldan on LAFC's left and the Sounders' right. But other question I have for you, we've seen Bouanga's quality so far. Stipe Buick, what'd you guys think of him in CCL?
He looks good. He looks good. I had my doubts the first time. Same with Tim Tillman. Like his first appearance for LAFC was not inspiring, but they what they showed against Portland was not apparently the real them. And both those guys have been very, very good.
All right, that's the biggest match of the weekend. Pre-game MLS season pass. Myself, Nigel Rio-Coker, Jillian Sakovitz, and then into the match on Big Fox and, of course, on Apple TV, as I said, on MLS season pass. St. Louis City SC, like they're undefeated. We have to preview this game against the Quakes, who are almost undefeated, you might say, like a couple of Thiago Almada bangers away. 8:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, MLS season pass. Bobby Sink is requesting that we just start referring to St. Louis City as all caps, like just as their moniker.
Just all caps.
Just the all caps, okay. Which I'm considering.
It will get confusing with Vancouver, I think, at some point.
Yeah, that's true. So we could still do City.
We could do Command Shift if you're an Apple person.
That's true. Or just slam on the caps lock. Maybe caps lock. I don't know. Still going to be confusing with Vancouver. Santiago Beltran, it says, is this game versus San Jose a good test to probe where St. Louis stands, or is it still too early in the season, Dave?
I think this is the best test they've had so far.
What a flattering entire premise for the Quakes.
Yeah. And if San Jose was home 100%, obviously going on the road a little bit tougher, but so far St. Louis has done a really good job. And I think we talked about this on Monday. They play in the attacking third. They make a lot of the actions occur in the attacking third. So when they make mistakes, they are not fatal because they're so far from goal. And when you make mistakes, they are because they're so close to your goal. San Jose hasn't made a ton of mistakes. Like the Thiago Almada hit two bangers. Those are the only two goals they've conceded. Otherwise they've been super balanced. They've been really professional. And then they have found their most dangerous players. I would add the ability to beat the press over the top to Jeremy Obobese and him hold it up. I think it's something Portland definitely didn't have. And I don't know that any of the teams they've played so far have done that really well. And so that's another challenge they're going to have to deal with. I mean, John Nelson defending Christian Espinoza 1v1 is going to be a huge test. And then Hybert trying to help there, but also deal with Obobese and Jamiro Montero.
Kyle Hebert.
Yeah, yeah. And Jamiro Montero coming into that space. So, yeah,
Montero's not going to play, man. He got a red at the end of that.
Violent conduct.
Yeah.
Just so a that's real
one of the,
silly
it's one. One of the big things, like one of the big interesting things with this is.
So,
like,
do they push Yule in there?
Well, I mean, they've been playing a three, right? So it's been a single pivot with Greitzo deep, yeah, and then Yule and Montero as.
So do they play another guy as an attacking player?
So is it going to be Jack Skahan because he was the first man off the bench, or is it going to be Nico Sekiris?
Lose my mind if Nico.
I mean, Nico Sekiris, you'll see him with the US U20s, a really, really promising young. I'm not going to call him a 10, but he's an 8 with, I think,
an elite pass
tendency.
This
would be like toss him into the blender against this St. Louis team that presses you all over the field, man, and really tries to use that to fuel their attack. That would be it'd be quite a task for, I think, would be the kids' first minutes of the season. But to your point, there will be times where they play over the press and try to play directly to Jeremy Obobese, but I don't think that's going to be their default. I think they're going to try to play through it. I think they're going to try to keep the ball. I think that's what Lucci wants, and I think they've been really good at it so far this season. So it's another styles make fights type of game.
And if you're looking for players to watch, you know, maybe you're just a neutral. You're a chaos merchant. You just want to see good players, good games. Christian Espinoza, I know that maybe we haven't given him the love he deserves as much as we should have in the past, and I'll chalk that up to sort of like the San Jose teams that we were talking about and covering, both the results and the chaos that a certain manager brought. But Christian Espinoza is one of the most exciting players in the entire league, and it looks like Jeremy Obobese is on the brink of having another big season. All right, ETR games to watch here. Rick Ramos said, guys, we need to do a whole episode over the flyover teams. Keep the coastal teams to 30 seconds or less. So he said he'll give us St. Louis as a talking point. Thank you, Rick.
Weeby, as a flyover guy, can I just genuinely ask, like, what, like, is Chicago a flyover city? Is Ohio a flyover? Is Colorado?
I don't think in theory Chicago would be a flyover because it's sort of a connector, especially for United. But in MLS terms of the last decade, 1,000% a flyover city. Like, fly straight over it. Just don't even look down. He says, more love for, like, the Rapids, Minnesota, RSL, Kansas City, Dallas, or Houston. And by golly, Matt, you're here to give us a little bit of love for FC Dallas and Sporting Kansas City at 8:30 p.m. on Saturday.
Yeah, so FC Dallas have evolved a little bit year over year. They've become more direct is not the right way of putting it, but like a little bit less structured. And that was the thing that really stood out about how FC Dallas played last year. Like, it was very clearly Nico Estevez wanted to instill a positional play system, like very rigid, make sure, okay, you know, the midfielder drops here to get outside of the shape, which allows the left back to push up, which then the left winger comes inside. It was all like very rigid and patterned, and it served them well because their rest defense was so good. Anytime they lost the ball, they had people in position to prevent a counterattack. It's how they went from one of the worst defenses in the league in 2021 to, I think, they were the best defense in the West last year, or second best defense in the West last year. Now, obviously, there were other things as well. Martin Pius had a very good debut season. And
he still is, by the way. He's been absolutely magnificent this year.
But there were times, especially in the middle of the year, where Dallas would have control of the game but not turn that into chances, and certainly not turn it into goals.
Has that changed this year?
So they're not necessarily turning them into goals yet, but they are turning them into chances. They are running it. What it comes down to is they're releasing the front line earlier. Specifically Jesus Ferreira, he's doing fewer false nine things and more actual nine things in terms of running into the depth, trying to get behind the back line. He's a very pacey kid. Like, he's not a pure burner, but he's got some wheels.
He's the fastest player in MLS. Didn't we get that recorded? Wasn't that
we had that. It was last year from Second Spectrum, but it was like one run off of it was anyway.
Don't dismiss my man. Jesus.
Well, they're having him weaponize it a little bit. So he's been in position to basically just receive more progressive passes. And at the same time, they flipped the two eights. Last year, it was Leggett on the right, Pomacall on the left, specifically to drop Pomacall out of the midfield shape and allow that rotation where Farfan would push up on the left wing. They flipped him. Pomacall's now on the right, Leggett's on the left. So both of these guys are kind of inverted, where they have the chance when they get on the ball to sort of drive at goal with the ball. And we've actually seen, against the Galaxy especially, they created a number of chances from that sort of pattern of play, which is something that was missing last year. Like, every chance Dallas created last year had to come off like a 16 pass buildup. Now it's a little bit more free flowing. It's been interesting to watch. I'm not sure they're going to be good enough defensively playing this style. I think it exposes them to the counter, and I think it's going to ask for more creativity from their fullbacks than they're necessarily going to be able to get. It's also going to ask for better box movement from Ferreira and Velasco, which not their strong suit. But it's interesting. It tells me at least that Nico Estevez saw the problem down the stretch last year and is willing to try stuff to address it. On the flip side, Sporting Kansas City, we had questions about their defense. They've given up one goal in three games. We didn't have many questions about their attack, but they have forgotten how to do anything except cross the ball. They're crossing it like it's not Charlotte levels of bad, and it's not Austin versus Violette levels of bad, but they are settling for so many crosses, which is insane when your center forward is 5'8" and none of your wingers are the type to get onto the end of crosses. Like, they have to start playing Peter Vermees soccer again, which is just in the attack. It has not been evident at all.
It's crosses and it's shots from outside the box. So again, it goes back to settling. They're leading the league in shots outside the box. I think only Atlanta have taken
outside the box. Shallowy's had success sort of in that area,
And Tommy has two.
But everything right now from Shallowy specifically is slow. Like when he's confident, right? When he's confident, everything is sharp. And now he's allowing defenders to recover. I think I felt like I saw a lot of that. All the 0-0 ties blend together. Maybe it was the Colorado game. Maybe it was the Galaxy game. But it felt like Shallowy was in spaces where over the last 2 years, he takes an aggressive first touch and hits a shot. And he sort of lines up a defender. And then he takes a late shot that gets blocked.
And the crazy thing is, you know, you're talking about Dallas and this chance creation. They're at the near bottom of the league as far as just shots on goal per game. They're just not generating very many of those. The flip side is Kansas City leads the league in a bunch of these categories. You know, they're number one in chances created. Now, that's not to account for how good those chances are and what they come from. They're number one in shots on goal. You know, they are peppering. They just have not had really the quality, or as you said, Dave, sort of the moments of separation. So we'll see who can do that on Saturday. Toronto, Miami. That's your game, Dave. Alex Young hit us up and asked, if Toronto loses, do you think Bob Bradley will start to feel some heat? And while you address that question, I'm going to go try to find these Bernadeschi quotes after the result at the weekend, because we did not talk about those. And he was pretty pointed in his disappointment with the way things are going.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, maybe, and say no. Like, Bob Bradley helped build this team. They can't really change much at this point, right? They're locked into the contracts. The roster is how it is. What happens with Michael if you fire the guy, you know, his dad who he helped bring there, and who else then gets the finger pointed at them if that's what happens? And I've said a couple of times, I don't know tactically if there's a better coach in the league than Bob. So I don't think that would be the case. From the fans, it will. I mean, if you go, especially if they take a lead and don't win, if you go four games taking a lead and not being able to win, that would be really tough. And they've yet to play. I think the most frustrating thing if you're a Toronto fan is they've yet to play 90 minutes. They have yet to play a complete game in the way they want it. Their best performance in Atlanta, Bob specifically said, that's not how we want to play.
That was like survival.
Yeah, I think that was their best performance. That was
the best game they've played so far.
And if that's the case, that's no good. And
they didn't give up a legitimate chance against Atlanta. They scored a deflected goal.
They had one legitimate chance
on the road, but it was the best defensive performance and it was the most cohesive performance from start to finish. The Columbus game was two games, right? And the DC United game was two games. Like, they have not played a full match at a high level. I would argue Atlanta was the highest.
Here's those Federico Bernadeschi quotes. Quote, we need to play more football, more right pass on field and not long ball. We need to improve. We played three matches and we have one loss, two ties. This is not good for me and my mentality. For sure, we need 3 points on Saturday. For me, my mentality, this is not what we expected from the start. I'm very disappointed today. I feel bad because it's the first match in our stadium with our fans. It's cold and the people come in the stadium for us. And the people need the win, need the 3 points to be enthusiastic about the game.
I mean, Bernadeschi said he doesn't want to not win.
Yeah.
Huge one there. And also, he's been good. I think that's a frustrating thing for him. He's done everything he can, and the rest of it hasn't been there. So, but am I out of bounds here? Bob Bradley is a former every trophy winner, national team coach that you probably pined after for a while.
Yeah, I don't think you're out of bounds, especially this early in the season. I do think that there is serious pressure on the front office, on Bob, and on the squad to perform at a level that the investment would suggest. And not just investment, by the way, in, you know, Insigne, who is out again, groin stuff like triggered again. He's out for a couple more weeks, and Bernadeschi. You know, they gave Jonathan Osorio a new contract. They went and got Mark Anthony Kay. Michael Bradley is still sort of a core part of the team. They invested in the free agent side and Matt Hedges and in Sean Johnson. You know, they have a squad on talent that people, and I think that includes the supporters, that includes people around Major League Soccer, and clearly, based on what Bernadeschi said, it includes this playing squad, the stars of that squad, the coaches in the front office, should be playing better, whether starting from a results perspective or from an aesthetics perspective. And there's, you know, there's limited patience when you have all those factors swirling together. That's just the way it works.
Yep.
Can I flip things on the other side, which is this is Miami's first game since we've heard Gregory's out indefinitely.
6 months. They put a number on it. Okay. Yeah.
So that's the year? That's the season?
Is that? Theoretically, he could be back for the playoffs.
Okay. So this is their first game without him, which I think he is the most crucial piece they could have lost. Maybe one of the two center backs, you could argue as well, but that would be it. It's a team that's been built defensively. He is the only natural defensive midfielder of that group. I don't think Jean Mata can play that role. I don't think Bryce Duke is that guy. Obviously, you know, Jean and Stefanelli, right? They're not going to be put in there as well. So they have Victor Ulloa still on the roster as an option. They could pull Pizarro deeper.
No.
And just try and play with no defensive midfielder and try and, I don't know, pass their way out of defensive moments. This is a huge question mark for them. And I questioned them coming into the year. I think I was wrong over the first 3 weeks. Phil Neville has gotten water out of the rock a few times with Inter Miami. If he does it again, he's coach of the year. I mean, if this team gets a home playoff game, even if they sign Messi in the middle of the year, like this is probably your coach of the year if he's able to get the performances he needs to at this point with this group. So it's going to be fascinating to see how they play. And that should open the door for Toronto to control the game in central midfield the way they want to.
Do you mean blood from a stone?
No, water from a rock.
I'm searching.
Moses got water from a rock.
Yeah, Moses raised his arm, struck the rock twice.
Well, first time he asked, second time he struck it, which is a no-no.
All right. I put my hand up. Sorry.
Take the L on that one. Okay.
I'm taking the L.
Wait, wow. I think we need Anders to take the L too, because clearly
he says he capitulates. Yeah, he capitulates in the chat. Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs to know Andres got that one wrong.
I'm gonna take Anders. I'm gonna take New England Nashville 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Nashville haven't allowed a goal yet. I have a hard time believing that they'll allow one in this match on the road against the New England team that, in all likelihood, will not have Carlos Hill. Just have a very difficult time believing that. I was just running through some of the stats in the background this week as I prepared for the weekend. Nashville are, I think it's attempting 280 passes per match so far.
Yeah.
Like, now part of that is you played the Red Bulls on the road. But like, that can't explain it all. That's and you don't have Hany Mukhtar, but that's unreal. That's like nothing. Yeah. That's half of what the top team in the league is doing right now. So this is, to me, Hany Mukhtar in the preseason talked about it. We've talked about it year after year. Like, does Nashville have another gear that they can get to? Can they control games with the ball? They may yet get to that gear. We are not going to see that gear on Saturday, I don't think. Like, they are at their most effective still and always, drawing teams out of their own half into the Nashville half, turning the ball over and letting Hany Mukhtar run a break.
This is a good stat from Anders. He says lowest total XG conceded in MLS so far this season, 1.2 over three matches against Nashville. The next team's LAFC at 1.6, but LAFC have only played two games. So a full extra 90 minutes.
Again, like if you look at the passing number and you kind of extrapolate that out, there's no risk to be punished. Yeah. Like that's the whole concept, right?
So
like,
are you fine with everything or are you complaining about it?
I'm actually mostly fine with it.
Okay, because you were saying they don't have other ways to win, but I think what we're
seeing. But it's working and it still works.
Yeah, and what we've seen from St. Louis as well is like if you have a clear identity that your players fit into.
I'm mostly fine with it. I still do pine for a Nashville that can marry this sort of like defensive solidity with, again, that ability, as Hany said, to control the game a little bit more with the ball and do things on their terms. But maybe this is just the term that works because the defense was shakier last year when they did more of that. Hany being injured has sort of let them.
They didn't do more of that last year.
I thought they were a little bit more.
No, that was game state related. They were actually more expansive.
Two years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
More expansive. But that was, you know, they had Dax and Godoy in good form. And that's when I think their peak got higher.
Well, the problem here is it's not just Hany, it's Godoy too.
Right.
Like, Godoy is not a 32-game start player. He wasn't that in his mid to late 20s. He's been hurt now. So that's the part where if I'm Nashville, I understand why you're like, you know what? We might aspire to this, but like just brass tacks, like we got Hany Mukhtar. We've got a back line that can kill people if we don't take chances and we make defending super predictable. Let's just do that and we'll wait it out till the summer. We made a mistake
Who has said they aspire to it?
Only Hany. But he don't get to make the decisions.
No.
That's Gary's.
Yeah.
It's Gary, isn't it?
You could give a wish list, but you don't always get what's on the wish list.
That's true.
You know?
That's true. So I think this is going to be definitely a counterattack moment for Nashville, and we'll see what New England can do without Carlos Hill, assuming that is the case. They had a good start to the season against lower-tier opposition, let's say, in Charlotte and Houston, and kind of got exposed without their star man in L.A., as many teams will. But an early litmus test in the Eastern Conference. All right, mailbag time. 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com or tweet at me. Ash says, I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on a kind of manager swap. If you feel one team has the wrong manager for them, whether it's style or club philosophy, and another team has the one that suits them better, who would it be? Dave, you said you had a funny one.
Oh, I have one which maybe potentially goes against what I said before. But I think it would be interesting to swap Bob and Bruce. Bruce has historically done really well just managing like big name stars and sort of letting teams find themselves. And I think what we've seen from New England maybe is sort of on the opposite side of that Nashville St. Louis conversation of like having a clear identity for the pieces to fit into and having that identity over the course of 90 minutes and dominate games. Plus you have some young pieces
that's actually a good one.
I know.
Right.
I'm stoked about it.
Yeah, because you could play Bob's 4-3-3 with the you know, Latif and Noel Buck in front of Matt Polster. And then you could have Carlos Hill in kind of the Vela role. Like he's not going to put up the goals, but he'll still create the scoring chances. And then you have Dylan Barrero inverted as a left winger. And then you have 14 different center forwards to choose from. That's a good one, David. Okay. All right.
Yeah. I like it. I like it. I like it a lot. Okay. Soccer by Spencer. What team will find themselves in their current standing in the table at the end of decision day? He says it's way too early to know, but it makes it interesting with a new playoff format and potential wooden spoon contenders. So which teams, Doyle, do you look at these standings and say, yeah, this looks about right. I think they could probably end up in that spot.
Cincinnati. They're third in the East, but you know, tied for first on, well, I mean, about the same spot, right? Okay.
I guess they are tied on 7 points. So yeah, that is a tiny bit of cheating there, but
I thought we were trying to hit this clean.
Oh,
I think we'd shout out to Charlotte, Montreal, LAFC, and Chicago, bringing up the bottom of the East.
LAFC is going to finish second in the West. Sounders are going to win the West. LAFC will be second.
I'm going to throw a Portland shout out there, 8th right now in the West. That feels pretty solid. And a TFC shout, 11th in the East.
Wow.
Ooh. I think the bottom of the conferences feel,
yeah,
even now, 3 match days in, a tad accurate.
They sorted real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
You were on the Charlotte parade for a while.
Yeah.
You got off fast. This is Weeby. Last on, first off, but loudest one in the bus.
I'm not off, but boy, it doesn't look good right now.
Houston in 14th in the West.
Yeah, that one feels about right. Adam says, what's the best sandwich city, all caps, in MLS? Philly's got a shout here.
Is this based off? We've done this once before, like the seminal one, or like
I think it's like totality. Let's say you're going there for 4 days. You want to have 4 sandwiches. What's going to give you the best opportunity to get a variety in?
It feels like Austin would be high on this list.
What's your sandwich list in Austin?
Me, I've only been twice. I have places I could think of them, but
yeah. But like, what kind of sandwiches are we talking?
Oh, well, it's just a hipster city, so they're kind of like making. You know, everyone's fermenting their own pickles and stuff like that. So you're getting like decent quality, I think, across the board. Plus you add in like probably some decent tortas or semitas.
That's true. You get a good barbecue sandwich.
Yeah. That's another element.
I thought Boston had outrageously good sandwiches when I lived there, but that was almost 25 years ago. The Italian sections of Boston, like every corner had a deli that made just incredible grinders. You could get obviously amazing corned beef sandwich, and then like the Dominican population in around Boston, like they put some stuff. I'm not even sure what
you know, whether these are traditional Dominican sandwiches or not, but like it was like a combination of flavors and ingredients that I had never experienced to that point in my life. And I keep looking for it, and I can't even find it in New York, something similar. So, yeah,
I will give a shout to North Shore roast beef sandwiches, which is North Shore, Boston. Mm-hmm. That is like a legendary thin sliced good sandwich that they make. And there was a famous sandwich shop on my corner named Juan's, and it was the best sandwich I've ever had in my life. It would take him like an hour to make it, not even heating anything up. It was just an experience. Dude got on TV one time, I think maybe Diner, Drive-Ins, Dives, closed down a week later. None of the proper requirements, certificates, paperwork. Once he got big, he flew to
classic case of don't, like, if you don't avoid the spotlight, avoid the spotlight at all costs. All right, we end here. Nick Legman hit us up and said he found out that Andrew Wiebe and his family moved to the same northern New Jersey suburban town where I've resided for years. I will not dox myself here, but as such, I was rather amused to hear Andrew say on the most recent episode that the noise he heard during the recording was a tornado warning siren. Do not worry, Andrew. You're not in Kansas anymore. That siren has nothing to do with tornadoes. It is instead a siren that is sounded in town when there's a fire.
Zoo animals. Zoo animals.
Notify the town and its volunteer firefighters. Bear or deer? It's a very big disparity there. One could certainly say that it's an antiquated system. One would say that. But no need for Andrew to grab his family and head to the basement, the bathtub, or into the frame of a doorway. There's plenty of stuff to be aware of in northern New Jersey. But generally speaking, tornadoes are not one of them. Welcome to town. Enjoy the sirens. Speaking of bear escapes, the thing my wife is the most afraid of, just I think in life maybe, is just bears and the possibility of bear attack.
Yeah.
And so her realization that there are a number of bear sightings in and around this area of New Jersey has been quite terrifying.
You can get bear spray if you want.
This stems from many experiences, one of which was going to Tahoe and overhearing a conversation of a couple on vacation who said a bear broke into their car to eat a chocolate bar. And then literally for three straight nights in a wonderful cabin, just we lay awake in bed, just staring at the door, looking for shadows to move. Like, it was a very scarring experience.
We got legitimately charged by a baby bear in Jackson. And it was one of those great moments where you realize how you react to situations. I turn and my wife is 100, 200 yards away and I have not moved. But after that,
are you saying that your reaction was to fight a bear?
I always move towards danger. That's just how I'm wired. So I like to assess for a second before I react. Yeah,
the classic, like, should I interact with this baby bear?
It wasn't going to cross the street, and it didn't cross the street.
The baby bear is not the one you're worried about, Dave. Like, that's bear facts 101. Yeah. Anyway, Eric Erickson finishes off here. On Monday's show, you guys brought up congratulations to Charlie and Susanna and background noise. While leaf blowers, sirens, radiators, and even trains, I think we got one of those in this episode, have brought great moments to the show, nothing tops when Charlie raises hand to go pee during the show. And that is our final moment of this particular episode. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Monday to wrap up match day 4. Any thoughts? You know how to get at us. Adios. We'll be right back.